Hi, Larry Gassman and Walden Hughes, and today we speak with a longtime collector of radio programs. He also restores, also dubs from discs, and he's got a lot of stuff going. He's got a blog and a website. We'll talk about that, and he's been around the hobby for a long time. Not as long as some of us, but long enough. So welcome to the show, Randy Riddle.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
So you're just a tad younger than I, but you don't really remember a lot of radio. What spawned your interest in radio?
Well, it was really during kind of the second wave of interest in old-time radio, starting during the nostalgia boom in the mid-70s. You know, that's when you had, like, the bicentennial was coming up, so everybody was interested in history. Mm-hmm. And you had movies like Chinatown and Paper Moon. And I was just fascinated with the 30s and 40s and 30s and 40s music. They're playing a lot of Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman on the radio, on public radio. And I started running into old-time radio actually at my local public library one summer. They had a whole bunch of audio cassettes from different old-time radio vendors, and I just kind of dove into those because of my interest in the 30s and 40s and just fell in love with it and started collecting some tapes, but mostly LPs that were offered through mail order at that point. And just it just kind of took off from there.
You collected tapes initially. What other forms of media do you collect now as the years have gone by?
Oh, my. Well, I do have a small collection of 78s. Most of them are related to old-time radio, and some of those are on the blog. I have a large collection of LPs with just all kinds of music, 30s, 40s, pop, rock, even more recent kind of indie music, and a large collection of movies on Blu-ray and DVD.
When did you start adding transcriptions to the list, and why?
Well, that was back in the early 2000s, probably about 15 years ago. I had kind of rekindled my interest in old-time radio because so many interesting shows were popping up on the internet in MP3 format. And I was a little frustrated because the encodes were kind of low quality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them just weren't transferred very well. I knew from collecting 78s that there's ways to transfer these old recordings to make them sound a lot better. And so I kind of got frustrated with that. And I kind of got interested in collecting, seeing if I could find any of the original discs, and I started seeing some for sale here and there, noticing that, and decided to take the plunge. So I got a transcription turntable, and just dove into collecting, and just went with it.
It's interesting too, because the people who just get started with regard to old-time radio don't know any different. They can amass a collection in probably 6 to 8 hours if they just go straight with regard to downloading. They can download thousands and thousands of hours, and we used to have to tape all that stuff real time. A lot of us on open reel as well. But the encodes you didn't have to worry about, because if it was good quality from first or second generation, the sound was really good. And so I find myself going back to that a lot as I slowly digitize my open reel collection, and the sound is better because it's not been compressed as much. And I don't have a problem with MP3s as long as they're encoded properly, but so much of the stuff is just not in great sound, and artifacts are introduced, and it's just very frustrating for me, at least it is.
Yeah. So when I decided to start a blog, it took me a while to figure out how to get good encodes at the right level. And also I do a little bit of noise reduction on the transfers I make in post, and to really get a feel for how to do that without being destructive and not introducing a lot of artifacts. But sometimes you can't avoid it, because especially with the kind of discs that I collect, a lot of them are just in terrible shape, and there's not a lot you can do with them.
Do you rely on your hearing to know when you've become destructive?
Well, actually, that sometimes yes and sometimes no. The software that I use, there's two kinds of noise reduction you can do. One of them will just take away pops and ticks, and that's what I usually use. And the other kind will take away what the software thinks is surface noise on the disc. And in both of these pieces of software, and I don't use the one that takes away surface noise very much because I think it takes away too much. But with both of these pieces of software that I use, and I can't remember the name of them offhand, I've used them for so long. But with both of them, you can listen to, you can preview what it sounds like in its original form, what it sounds like with the noise reduction or click removal. And another option lets you listen to what it's taking out. And you can adjust the settings and listen for where it's taking out the program material. You can figure out where it's taking out too much and kind of back it off from that.
Yeah, good. Because I remember long ago when we didn't have this kind of computer-related software, people used to be called noise gating. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And some people just did some really bad jobs because they took out too much.
Right. And like I say, particularly with the type of transcriptions that I collect, they're really a lot of them are kind of what I would call throwaway discs that people literally threw in the trash. And they're not in very good shape. So I try to get them so they're at least listenable. But I'm very fortunate to have many that are in great shape and clean up very nicely. And some that sound close to hi-fi.
Of the material that you found with regard to transcription discs, which are you most proud of that you feel, wow, I've done something to really preserve something that's really good and memorable?
Well, I have preserved some really interesting, really entertaining shows and some really terrible shows that are at least historically significant. I guess a couple of things I'll bring up that really are significant that I've been able to find have been a couple of suspense episodes that were previously lost on Armed Forces radio discs. One is called The Lost Special with Orson Welles, and that concerns a train that is lost. It's not a lost special broadcast, even though it was lost at one point. And it's based on a Conan Doyle story.
I remember hearing it on Escape first, and then later I think I heard your copy from Suspense.
Right. And then the second one was an episode of Suspense where we only had like half of the show or three quarters of the show, and we didn't know how it ended. And I found an Armed Forces disc of it, Jimmy Stewart in The Rescue, where there's a doctor trying to kill this woman and Jimmy Stewart's trying to help her. So we finally figured out, you know, what happened with that story because it was incomplete for so long. But probably the one that got me the most excited, and I really thought about just stopping collecting after I found this because I thought I can never top this. Was a copy I found of The War of the Worlds, the original Mercury Theater broadcast. And when I was looking at this, that you have to remember that the show was recorded back in the 30s when it was broadcast live. And there's a couple of copies floating around that have been used to make a lot of copies over the years. And like in the, I think sometime in the 1940s, at Radio Recorders, they used a set of discs to make dubs of this show. Mm-hmm. And I thought what I had found was one of those dub sets that were made in the 40s. And I didn't really pay that much for it, really. But when I got it and played it, I was absolutely shocked. Because I think it's the Mercury Theater's reference copy of the program, and it's absolutely complete from start to finish. It has two or three sections in it that are missing from all the other circulating copies. And I think, based on the research I've done, is that the discs that were commonly used to make the version that everyone heard had gotten damaged, and there were just little parts edited out. A couple of the parts were near the end of sides, mm-hmm. and another one was a couple of sentences of one of Orson Welles' speeches in the show. But this was absolutely complete, start to finish, with just fantastic sounds. And I thought, after I found that, I was like, you know, I might as well stop collecting, so I'll never find anything that good ever again.
Now, were these the discs that originally belonged to Paul Stewart?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
At least I think they belonged to Paul Stewart. They came from the estate of a guy who collected science fiction memorabilia. And the discs themselves are Green Label Presto discs, uh-huh. recorded at 78 RPM. So there's like 10 sides to the whole show. And it had Paul Stewart's name written on it. Mm-hmm. And the information I got from the seller who was clearing out the estate was that he had gotten that from Paul Stewart. And at that time, Paul Stewart was kind of the business manager for the Mercury Theater.
Right.
And he would have been in a position to have those. I did a little bit of digging, and they were making multiple copies of the shows. They made like a 16-inch set that was sort of kind of the master reference set. For the Mercury, but they also made like 78 sets for Orson Welles' personal library. Mm-hmm. Those wound up in Lilly Library in the Midwest right. somewhere.
Right.
And I think Sammy Jones got a set right. or something like that.
Sammy had a set. I thought Michael Beale had a set. Jerry Hendigas had a set at one time. So there are about three or four or five different sets.
Sammy's set's kind of interesting because at Lilly Library, the Orson Welles sets, all of the shows are there and they're on 12-inch 78s. However, they're missing the War of the Worlds set. And the one that's there is a dub that was made in the 40s from the 16-inch disc set. So it's not an original like the others. And Sammy's, based on the labeling on it and everything, we think that is the Orson Welles set that should be in Lilly Library, but somehow got switched out when Orson had his collection at some point. And the one that Michael Beale had was actually a reel-to-reel tape that I think may have been a copy at the Library of Congress or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For our audience, Paul Stewart at this time did directing of the rehearsals
right.
for Mercury Theater. And so that's why, because, you know, if you recall, Orson was busy with theater, had other obligations, and so generally fell this time to Paul Stewart to run the rehearsals.
And later on, he was living out here, and we had a chance to meet him. This is in the 80s, I think early to mid-80s, yeah.
Yeah, I think he passed away mid-80s, if I recall. Yeah.
Yeah, so that makes me wonder if Paul Stewart had this set of discs of War of the Worlds. Did he have other sets of other shows in the series?
I can't imagine why he wouldn't.
Yeah, so you wonder what happened to those over the years.
I do.
I'm trying to remember when Richard Wilson.
That's what I was just thinking.
Yeah, I remember Wilson had a box.
Yep.
Of 70 some odd shows that Orson told him to hang on to, and right. I'm trying. That's where the set that when Orson passed away, the one that came out on cassettes and laser discs. Well,
that's part of where Theater of Imagination came from.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't know whatever happened to those discs.
Yeah, I don't know.
And by the way, I have a Laserdisc player and some Laserdiscs, and I have that. That Orson Welles Laserdisc that Voyager put out.
What was that like? Because all I got with the cassettes. I think most of it got the cassette. What was the laser disc?
This is the one with the documentary.
Was there visual companionship with it? What was the laser disc?
It was a book.
It was the only laser disc, that anyone ever knows of that was released with audio only.
Right.
When you play the disc, it just gives you a black screen. But it uses the multi-channels of the laser disc to give you all of this material on one disc.
Gee, just think, if Walden and I had gotten a copy of that disc, we would have never known. Yeah, that's probably true. Because I've never saw the laser disc. I got cassette copies and a book, and Leonard Maltin did the documentary, and I remember talking to him about it.
When I got it for Christmas, I remember when I saw it was $75 when it first came out.
Yep, well,
yeah, pretty hefty, $75, $80,
I think,
something like that.
We got a copy for free because we had
the radio show.
We had, well, yeah, but we had Richard on.
Yeah.
I don't remember whether we had Leonard on. We might have, but we did a lot of publicity. We also got them on Jim Bohannon's show.
Right.
For Mutual, because they were looking to do some publicity, and we knew some of those people. So we called, and so they were on a few radio shows to plug it. I have no idea whether it ever made them any money. I don't know.
Well, remember, KCRW ran the whole thing.
Yep.
And they sat down with an interview with John Houseman afterward, too. I remember.
You know, I do remember that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever taped it. I can't remember. I'd have to go back and look and see if it's sitting around somewhere.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of my kind of ongoing projects is trying to document this War of the Worlds set. So I've been doing research on what surviving War of the Worlds discs there are, or Mercury Theater discs in general, where they seem to have come from, how this might have come to be recorded, and that kind of thing. But they're definitely from the time of the broadcast, because they're green label Presto discs.
Now, Randy, when you look at the discs, were they out of CBS? No, I don't think CBS had its own recording process in house. They contracted with.
Well, no, they wouldn't have. If they're Prestos, company, they wouldn't have been CBS's.
Yeah, based on the research that I've done, I think they had an outside recorder that did these for them
in New York.
In New York, they had access to the New York line.
Right.
Unfortunately, what someone did to my set is over the years, the original labels are gone. So what you see is just the original painted Presto green label thing.
Ah.
And pasted over that are plain white labels where someone has written War of the Worlds and the part number. And the labels look to be actually from the LP era, because they're larger than the lacquer labels that would have been typical for that time period. So they were added later. But a couple of them fell off, and you could see that they were green label Prestos underneath.
I think when Michael Beard and I were discussing Kate Smith around 30, I think it was Smith Studio something. Maybe I'm fouling up the company.
Are you thinking of Raymond Scott's studio?
No. I'm trying to think of Ted Streaker. Ted.
Are you talking about
Kate Smith?
Oh, Harry Smith. You're thinking of Harry Smith.
Harry Smith. Yeah, Harry Smith Recording Studio. I think it might have come from them, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe that they were doing recordings for CBS at the time and the Mercury Theater. I actually have some I used to have some later, around 1940, 41 lacquers that Harry Smith cut of... some kind of drama. I can't even remember what it was now, but I have seen some other things he did, or that studio did. So that's really the most exciting thing I've found. It kind of has an honored place in my collection.
So I guess the question is, have anybody tracked down the Harry Smith paperwork? Were they donated to some university? That way maybe we can see some documentation about that recording section or something.
I've tried to find that. I haven't been able to find out anything about it. I even tried tracking down to see if Paul Stewart's papers or John Houseman's papers were somewhere that might include some of the business records from the Mercury that might have a receipt for these discs being made. And I couldn't find anything. So apparently these were just the stuff was just thrown out years ago. So
interesting. What about some of the other parts of the collection, Randy? You sure got a lot of Singing Sam. Were they all come together at one batch?
With these Harry Frankel discs?
Yes.
Yes, the Singing Sams, those all came together. And again, a lot of what I collect I try to find things that are kind of neglected among old-time radio collectors. And so I wind up with like groups of discs that someone threw away at a radio station or someplace years and years ago, and they wound up in somebody's attic. And the Singing Sams were like that. They were part of like this big box of transcriptions I got from a guy in the Midwest that were just throwaway discs. And so these were the syndicated show. They were a little beat up. But there was just this whole group of Singing Sam shows in there. Yeah.
Are you generally the only one that's bidding on them if they come on eBay, those types of discs, or is it, or is there anybody else that have that kind of interest?
Well, it varies. Sometimes I can get interested in some odd thing on eBay and somebody will swoop in and get it. And other times, like the War of the Worlds disc, there was absolutely no one else that had any interest in it. It was up on eBay for a few weeks for sale. And I finally just decided to try it and see. It looked interesting. And yeah, there's a lot of things I found on eBay that just that no one else is interested in. One of the most interesting ones, at least to me, I found 11 discs of a show called Your Homefront Reporter. It was on CBS daytime back in during the war, and it had it was a mix of music. It was like a half-hour show with a mix of music, kind of light classical stuff, and sort of news items and stuff about the war that was tailored to housewives. It was sponsored by Corning Glassware. And there was this whole group of these, and they were coming from some estate, that were in their original shipping containers, the original sleeves. They had never been played. And they had been sent to some executive at Corning Glassware back in the 40s during the war. And apparently he just put them away and never played them. And somebody dug them out and sold them on eBay.
Wow.
So I look for weird things like that.
How often have you found air checks from North Carolina, your home area? Have things popped up over the years?
Nothing really. I do keep an eye out for local programming from different areas, but I've really not found anything from North Carolina. Now, you have to remember that, North Carolina being part of the South, we were kind of economically depressed and didn't really start to take off economically until really after the war. We didn't really have as many radio stations that would have had recording equipment, probably, that was used on a regular basis. Like WBT in Charlotte, it was a big station at the time. But they were, big in country music and that kind of thing. And some of their stuff was heard nationally on network, on CBS. But I've never seen any of their discs turn up. And in the smaller stations here, like in Winston-Salem or Burlington, a lot of those were, they were network outlets, but I'm not even sure if they had the equipment to actually record shows until later.
Yeah, because I just have one. my surrogate mom, Kitty Callan, was on the MGM Musical Comedy Theater with Mickey Rooney, Babes on Broadway in 1952, and All Survive is the middle part of the show from some station out of North Carolina that air-checked it for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the front is gone and the back is gone, but somehow Golden Put It Under came from a station in North Carolina. So I guess that there was some station that recorded in, at least in 52 or so. So.
Mm-hmm. I know that I have found some groups of discs that appear to be, you know, around 47, 48 from two or three different stations that sounded like they were time shifting stuff. Mm-hmm. Probably because of, you know, the time change for summertime or maybe something accommodating something in their schedule. There's a big group I posted on my blog fairly recently over the past few months of different shows that were time shifted by a station in Ohio, in Akron, Ohio, I believe. And there were some local shows mixed in with that. Because what they would do is they would just grab a couple of blank discs and record a show, say a half-hour show on two discs on, you know, on the sides of those. And they'd have the other side that would be blank, and they might use that for something else, like a local show. So you would get a mix of things on these discs.
Yeah, because the big personality I always think of during the golden days of radio that came from North Carolina with Kay Kaiser. And I'm assuming he went back to the hometown, the home area, and recorded some things. Of course, Les Brown went from North Carolina, went to Duke and others. So maybe they donated to the schools. I don't know.
I know with Kay Kaiser, his papers and memorabilia and things were donated to University of North Carolina, where he went to school and where his band started.
Yeah.
And he actually was a major figure in starting North Carolina Public Television in the 1950s. So he was very well loved by his alma mater for how involved he was after he came back home at the end of his, when his career was declining and you know, did some things for the university and starting North Carolina Public Television.
Yeah, because I learned, I talked to his daughter, and she, over the years, been trying to raise funds to do a video documentary on her dad, but it's just been a tough go for her to do something.
Chat again and see if she's any closer to that.
Down in Kimberly
mm-hmm.
Kaiser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he'd be an interesting guy to do a documentary about. I've got a RKO film he did that has Peter Lorre in it, and the other two horror icons,
Boris Karloff,
Boris
Karloff, and Bela Lugosi. Bela Lugosi, all three of them in a kind of musical comedy mystery. And Kaiser is really good in it. He has a really good sense of comedic timing. He's actually a pretty good actor.
What about the blog? When did you decide to put together a blog, and how big of a challenge was that for you, the learning curve and trying to get it off the ground?
Well, I initially put together the blog, I guess, maybe about 7-8 years ago. And initially it was kind of technically challenging because at that time there were podcasting sites. But they didn't give you a lot of space to work with, as far as, you know, where you could put up your audio. And so I had to figure out, you know, what kind of site to get and everything. But the main thing that my kind of main motivation for doing it was to share, you know, some of the things that I had in my collection, with other folks. But the thing that I wanted to do was something that I didn't see anyone else doing, and that was trying to put up a write-up about the show and about the disc, and trying to document what I knew about the disc itself. So each post has a picture of the label, and I try to include information on, like, the matrix numbers on the disc. And this information is really important for kind of tracking down dates of shows or, you know, tracking down where some of these things came from. And a lot of people weren't doing that when they were sharing MP3s. So I really wanted that that information around it. And, you know, part of the motivation, because I collect all this kind of stuff that has kind of been forgotten, you know, I can do so much research on a show or a series that maybe no one has ever heard of. But, you know, there's some things where I just couldn't find out a lot about them. And so I've just put them out there and say, what, you know, do you know anything about this? Have you dug up anything? What do you think this is? Or where do you think this came from? Or who are these people? What is this? So some of it is like that too. And it's been interesting. It's created kind of a dialogue, with people who, you know, I'll put up something and maybe I can't find that much about it. And other people chime in and find ads for the show or, copyright registrations or other kinds of things, that really kind of rounds out the whole kind of information that we have about, some odd little series from the 30s that no one's ever heard of.
So if people want to hear more about your blog, where would they go?
Well, unfortunately, when I created the blog, I didn't think that a lot of people would be interested in it because, you know, I'm not – even though I do post a few popular shows like Suspense and that kind of thing, a lot of the stuff that I post is pretty esoteric. And I didn't think there would be that many people interested in it. And so I didn't really choose a great name for it. It's not easy to type in. It's called Rand's Esoteric OTR. And the URL is randsesotericotr.podbean.com. But the easiest way to find it, if you don't want to write all that down, is just go to Google and type in esoteric space OTR. And my blog will be the first thing that shows up.
Good. Okay.
What were some of the interesting emails or contacts you've gotten over the last 7-8 years? Anything really you were surprised about?
Well, it's interesting when people find out that I collect this stuff. Then, you know, I'll get people contacting me saying, well, I've got a box of old discs, you know, in the attic, you know, do you want them? So some of the things that wind up on the blog, people literally just mail them to me because they don't have a way to play them. Maybe they're interested in old-time radio, but they don't know what this is exactly. So I've had some wonderful people just send me stuff for free. Sometimes I've had people, I can't remember the name of the show, but there was like some kind of local little dramatic kids show. I think it might have been Mystery Castle, and I got a message from someone who I think their mother appeared in the show. And so once in a while you get people who will contact you and they have a relative who appeared in a radio show or that you post or something like that.
Anything you want to do with it the next couple of years or just play it by ear, Randy? What's your hope for it?
Well, I'm just kind of playing it by ear. One of the things that I've done in my collection, because, again, I collect shows that no one has ever heard of before. And like I say, some of these shows are really entertaining and bear repeat listening. And the discs are interesting. And some of those, you know, I hold on to. But there's a lot that I find that are historically significant. But after transferring them, I really don't want to hear them again. And I'm really not interested in keeping the discs around. So, a few years ago, I started donating batches of them to, Duke University, to the Rubenstein Library there that has, collections on, advertising history, African-American history, and women's history. And they've been using that to supplement some of their other collections. So I'm always on the lookout for odd things that might fit with stuff that they collect at Duke to add to their collections, just to give it to them. So eventually, probably all my discs will wind up there when I'm gone. But I'm slowly giving them, you know, the transfers and the original discs of many of the things that I have that I probably will never listen to again, like the American Family Robinson. I can't stand that show, but I have to collect as many as I can because I seem to be the only one digging them up.
Isn't it sad? There's a bunch of those running around, but you got a limited amount with regard to shows like Sam Spade and other shows where there's very few examples, yet Robinson's got quite a few floating around.
Yeah, and practically all of those came from a couple of collections where I found big groups of them. Uh-huh. And I just posted another group of them that I'll be taking over the Duke in a few months, probably. it's a dreadful show.
The other thing I think about Duke is I think that's where the J. Walter Thompson archives were donated to. So anybody who wants to do paperwork research, I think that they're at Duke.
That's right, and that's one of the things that got me interested in donating these to Duke is that they have a lot of documentation about old radio shows that came from not just J. Walter Thompson, but several other of the big advertising agencies. They have a lot of that stuff on microfilm, like scripts and internal correspondence from the ad agencies about the shows. But what they don't have are the discs because the advertising agency didn't save the discs of the shows. So some of the things I'm finding, are able to supplement things that they have in those advertising collections so that they actually have recordings of the shows that are documented in other ways.
I think for the audience, I think that's where Art Pearson, I think it's co-author on the Lux Radio Theater book. I think that's where they got most of the documentation.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, they're at Duke. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do the J. Walter Thompson archives?
Mm-hmm.
Great book.
Well, Randy, anything else you want to mention before we let you have the rest of your evening?
Well, I would just encourage people if you're interested in getting kind of off the beaten path of old-time radio and kind of exploring the other kinds of things that were on the air when, you know, after Jack Benny or Suspense wasn't heard, something that would be on during the day or odd hours of the day on radio, just come check out my blog. And I'm always interested, again, in finding out more about a lot of these kind of weird shows that I've dug up that I can't find out a lot of information on. So, you know, if people could look at them and maybe something will ring a bell or maybe they can think of another avenue to look up something, they might be able to give us some more information about some of these weird little shows in my blog.
One interesting thing that Randy has posted, everybody, and concerning Harris Burvac, we just did a recreation at the Long Beach Veterans Hospital in March. Randy has up there from 1955, it looked like a closed circuit broadcast for all the different veterans hospitals. So I don't know if they just sent records around to the different hospitals to be played or what, but that was really fascinating when you had that available, Randy.
Yeah, and again, that was another one of those odd discs that just turned up in a whole bunch that came out of somebody's attic. So, you just never know what might turn up. And again, I've gotten actually some lacquers, 16-inch lacquers, that have absolutely no information on them, and I have no idea what I'll hear when I actually put it on the turntable and play it. And sometimes it's a radio show. Sometimes it's just somebody playing around testing equipment or whatever. So you take a chance, and sometimes you get lucky and find some interesting stuff.
You know you've really arrived esoterically when your stuff you find is not on J. David Golden's site.
That's right.
It's true.
I've actually been very amused since I've been doing the blog because I've found some like old 30s radio shows or other kinds of things that Golden doesn't have listed, and then I'll go back a few months later after I post them on my blog and he'll have them listed there.
Wow.
So he's looking at what I'm posting up there. Like there was a like a 1930 show with two vaudevillians called The Two Daffy Dills. And he had one show listed there, and I ran into like a half a dozen others and posted them. Sure enough, a few months later, he added those to his site. So he keeps up with this stuff.
Good. It's a great database.
It is.
It is.
I actually use that when I'm if I get in a show I'm not familiar with or wanting to look up something, I'll go there first to see if Golden has run into it somewhere before. And sometimes I get lucky and find things that he doesn't have there, and that's when it gets really fun. And I do a little original research.
That's wonderful. One wonderful thing about the internet, you know, because 30 years ago we didn't have the internet, we didn't have all these sites, and when we wanted to look up stuff, we'd have to rely on the books or maybe go to the library. Now it's literally at your fingertips. There's so many wonderful sites where so many people have done all the work or a lot of it, and you can have stuff. 10 seconds later, 20 seconds later, you just go look it up and there it is.
Yeah, I remember back when I was collecting the LPs, you'd get a lot of those that didn't identify when the show was broadcast or anything. Mm-hmm. And like Golden's catalog was one thing I would try to look up stuff in. His printed catalog that he had at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had another book. It was actually published in the 50s, and they reprinted it in the 70s. That summarized the ratings for every radio show on the major networks between like 1929 and 1955.
It sounds like Harrison B. Summers.
Yeah, and you could use that, say, if you knew who the mm-hmm. sponsor was, you could kind of flip through there and say, okay, well, that was probably from that season, and then try to figure out, you know, from internal clues, what the show, when the show might have been broadcast. So you would do odd things like that, and now you can just kind of, you know, you can look at like old newspapers and billboard magazines and things like that, and really, really just dig up some fantastic info on this stuff.
I don't know if Jay Hickerson have updated his, you know, book that he had going for all those years, The Ultimate Research Guide, or whatever he dubbed
it. I get his, you know, hello again, of course, but I haven't seen it updated in a little while.
And so that used to be the way you sort of see it with new discoveries. Mm-hmm. So all Randy's discoveries since then is probably not even in the book. So,
well, not yet. I'm sure they'll show up there eventually.
Sure. Oh yeah.
But that's really been the most rewarding part of doing all this is I started it out like everybody else listening to the big popular radio shows that were circulating around a lot, and I've been able to hear some of the most fascinating parts of old time radio that had just been completely forgotten, and sometimes they've really shocked me and surprised me. I have one series from the early 30s called Police Reporter, a little 15-minute drama, and they would do these dramatizations of true crime stories, and I swear that show is grisly.
I know which one you mean. From 36?
It really surprised me.
I know what you mean. How
graphic that show was. I'm like, wow, that was before the censors really clamped down. It's like watching pre-code movies, you know.
And another thing you've collected, which I was very happy because I know I have an interest, Larry's having, it's the music. Not all old-time radio collectors are interested in the music shows, so I'm glad you at least have posted those up too. So, because sometimes that gets sort of forgotten in the hobby.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people concentrate on the comedy and the drama. But, you know, I think the music shows are really interesting because you can find some really interesting performances. And there was one show, I wish I could find more of these. I found two of them called Harlem Hospitality Club that mm-hmm. had these wonderful rhythm and blues artists from late 40s, kind of the precursor to rock and roll, doing this live kind of audience participation show. And these people would, and the audience would, the host of the show would go out and interview them, and they tell these really interesting stories about their grandmothers and different things. Really, really fascinating stuff. But no one seems to have remembered that.
Yeah.
But But yeah, the music shows are really, really interesting. And another thing I tend to look for is soap operas. I'm addicted to daytime soap operas. Because what survives of those is just so spotty. Right. I always look for those.
Yeah, we also collect interviews. John and I have done probably 400 or 500 of them in various formats. But we interviewed the people. Other friends of ours have interviewed the people, and that's an aspect of the radio hobby that's not collected as much. And so we've begun that process to gather as much as we can, so that in years to come, after we're gone and others are gone, if the hobby still exists, there'll be at least some sort of history.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for somebody like National Public Radio to do a Ken Burns style multi-part epic documentary about old time radio that uses like the surviving interviews that were done like in the 60s and 70s with some of the people involved in the 80s and excerpts of the old shows. I mean, you know, that's just ripe for someone at National Public Radio to do.
It would be nice. There have been some people who have done a couple years of it, but, you know, nothing really huge, nothing extensive.
Yeah, well, small version. I remember they went to you, Larry and John, on the Woman in Radio. So I think you opened with Troy and joined a few others.
Yeah.
And they did little
pieces.
Documentaries on little segment features and things.
Yeah, but there's really not been anything that's done, you know, with this kind of a full overview of that whole era.
Yeah,
you know, it'd be nice.
And the BBC did the Radio Detectives, which was nice, but
remember they did the thing on Peg Lynch about 12 years ago.
You know, maybe we need to see if we can find somebody rich to contract Ken Burns to go to National Public Radio to do that. If there'd be any money in it for him, and I think it'd be great.
Actually, you might get Steven Spielberg, because I hear he's fascinated with War of the Worlds.
Yep, I hear that too.
Well, I know who's a big old-time radio fan.
Yes.
It's the creator of Star Wars, George Lucas.
George Lucas
gave USC, his NPR station, all the radio rights to Star Wars for $1 that he wanted it to produce. I know he's a big old-time radio fan. So I imagine after he sold the Star Wars property to Disney, he could keep coming up $4 billion and help us out.
Yeah, I think so. And actually, you've brought up another interesting thing. I think a lot of people have forgotten about the really wonderful audio dramas that NPR was doing in the mid-70s into the early 80s.
Oh, absolutely.
Like Hitchhiker's Guide and the Star Wars, but there were several others that I remember hearing.
There was Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You know,
and the Intergalactic Gumshoe thing. I can't remember the name.
Oh, my God. I don't remember what it's called either. I'll have to go back and look.
Didn't they do a Philip Marlowe, like a six-parter or something?
NPR and APR both did stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, so there was during the time that I first got into old-time radio, there was this contemporary radio drama thing that was going on, and it wasn't just CBS Radio Mystery Theater. No. It was NPR is a big part of that.
It was great, but they ran out of money.
Ray Bradbury had a series in the early 80s, I think.
There was some great stuff done then.
Well, what was the big play, the big series out of Wisconsin? Was that Airplay? What was that? It was the
Airplay.
Yeah.
Yep. So hopefully, and a lot of those have been preserved, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're kind of they don't really circulate or not really for sale.
No.
A lot of them, so you can't really hear them today, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
But maybe someday they'll start circulating again.
Yeah, I would hope.
It'd be nice if they would start broadcasting them again, get a whole new generation interested in this stuff.
I interviewed a gentleman last weekend who is from the BBC, who worked for the BBC, and this was really surprising to me. Because we know the BBC has many channels broadcasting over there. But in the domestic department, the most popular division is the archive division. They have a digital stream that's nothing from the archives. Of course, you know, most people know the BBC did not do a good job preserving the early stuff, the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But, you know, after that point, that is, he would tell me that the numbers show that is the most popular stream that they have in the domestic English market.
Hmm, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, can I quickly tell you a really fascinating story about one of these odd things that came my way?
Sure.
Sure.
I was contacted maybe about 4 years ago by a guy who lived in Seattle. And his next door neighbor had these huge boxes full of discs. They were transcriptions. He figured that out. And somehow he had found me through the web. And his neighbor was about to throw them out. And he was wondering if anyone was interested in them. And I was like, hey, tell me all about it. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the Old Time Radio Researchers Group to actually get these. And it turned out that he had, the neighbor had gotten these in Asia, in Japan, I think, when he was in the military in the early 70s. Somebody was cleaning out a closet full of transcriptions, and he packed them up and sent them home to Seattle, and they'd been in his garage all that time, and he never did anything with them. But included in that were there were four boxes of 1940s BBC transcription discs. And these were the service where they would send out discs?
Like Armed Forces or the AFRS or was it something?
No,
like?
It was BBC.
Yeah, it was a BBC,
Home Service?
Home Service, wasn't it? Yeah.
Or Transcription Service, I think.
Okay.
But it had all of these BBC shows that were not in their archives. And so I felt very privileged to transfer all of those. And I tried to figure out a way to get the original disc to them, but it was too expensive to send them, and we couldn't figure out a way to get them to disc, but they have all of the digital files in their in the BBC archives now.
Great.
And the original discs, we donated those. I can't remember the university. It was one in California took the original discs. But there was like a whole group of lost BBC shows. And again, because of the copyright and the way BBC controls that, I didn't post any of that on my blog. But those were really interesting because they were from like 1945, 46, and 47, just right when the war was winding down.
Yeah, because one interesting thing I have in the BBC, and I can't show really play it because it's fascinating, is the Glenn Miller, you know, who is there from London, and I think the female vocalist is Ian Shilton, and it's, you know, it's broadcast over the Home Service of the BBC, and it's just a wonderful studio recording with Miller and the band for, you know, for a half hour, and I just strictly being through the BBC lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these were like a range of things. Some of them were drama shows that hadn't been heard in a long time, and some music shows, and they were all stuff from the BBC Home Service. And one of them was like this 1 hour broadcast about Hitler and Mussolini's correspondence, and it had recently come out. It had been released by the Allies as part of some documentation effort, and they like dramatized the letters between Hitler and Mussolini during the war. And this was like in 46 or 47.
Wow!
So really, really interesting stuff. So all kinds of fun stuff out there. if you just dig a little bit and look for it.
So once again, Randy, for people to find your blog, where should they go?
The easiest way to find it is to go to Google or your favorite search engine and type in Esoteric OTR or Esoteric Old Time Radio, and it should be right at the top of the search results because I'm the only one doing Esoteric Old Time Radio.
Randy, thank you for doing this.
All right, no problem. I enjoyed it. All right. You all have a great evening.
Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.